Voice America Talk Radio Network.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right. Welcome back, everyone. It's great to have everyone with you today. This is the beginning of March Madness. We're going to celebrate the beginning of March Madness by having a Capital Thinking devoted purely to higher education issues, since everyone's attention has turned to campus. And for the first half hour, we're joined by a really cool innovator doing a variety of things that have to do with voting technology and also about human-centered computing. We're going to learn a little bit more about those topics with our special guest, Dr. Juan Gilbert. Dr. Gilbert has a BS in system analysis and a PhD in computer science. He is at Clemson University, where he's doing some cutting-edge research in electronic voting that's helped give us some new accessible voting system interfaces. He's received a number of national honors for his work. He's testified before Congress, among many things, on innovative work in electronic voting. So, Dr. Gilbert, welcome to the show. Delighted to have you on board. And let's start by educating our audience a little bit about what you do and what the concept of human-centered computing is all about.
Well, hi, Kevin, and thanks for having me. Sure, I'd love to talk about that. Human-centered computing, it's a new or emerging discipline where we focus on understanding how to design, build, and evaluate computational technologies as they relate to the human condition and how these technologies affect society. So what we do in human-centered computing, the concept is that you have individuals who, before human-centered computing, or HCC, you have individuals who can design things. You give them a problem, they design a solution. Then you have another team that comes in and actually builds or implements stuff. Then you have another team that does the evaluation, the effectiveness of it. So we're training graduate students and doing research that integrates all three, designing, building, and evaluating. And so when we do that, our work is naturally applied, meaning we deal with real-world problems in real-world contexts. And so they have societal impacts. So that gives you a little background on what human-centered computing is and what we do in that arena. We have a PhD program in human-centered computing, and so does Georgia Tech and the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and there are others that are being created. So it's an emerging discipline that tends to have the ability to have societal impacts.
Gotcha. Well, so let's talk about some of those societal problems. Why don't you walk us through some specific examples of what human-centered computing can do?
All right. Well, you kind of highlighted one of the things that we work on. We deal with voting, making voting more accessible, and I'll talk more in detail about that. But we also have problems that we work on in learning. We have faculty doing research on how to make learning easier, using technology, using games to teach kids and things like that. We do research in security space, but the security space is a little different. We do stuff what we call identity science, meaning integrating people and security. So we do work in virtual reality. We're rehabbing stroke victims using virtual reality, where they can actually have a trainer or a coach in a virtual world that helps them. So those are a few examples of some of the things we do. And my specialty that we've worked on extensively has been in the voting area to make voting more accessible for everyone, meaning people with disabilities and those without. So that's just a little background on some of those projects, and I can go in detail on the voting project. which was funded by the United States.
Dr. Goodwin, let me hold you up there, because we are definitely going to talk about the voting technology stuff. I want to come back to the stroke thing. I think that's got to be of interest to a lot of people. So talk to us a little bit about what you – give us a little more detail on what you do in that area.
Okay, so I have some faculty members in my division. So, again, we're a school of computing at Clemson University, and I'm the chair of human-centered computing. And so I have faculty – who are building virtual worlds. So imagine if you had a stroke and you have limited use of one of your arms. And so what they're doing is using a virtual world with like a Microsoft Kinect, where you sit in front of a TV and it asks you to lift your arm and reach and grab something. And so you imagine a virtual version of your arm on the screen. And as you move your arm, it moves with you. And as you reach, it reaches. So it's a form of rehabbing. And that actually won a second place national award, that technology, in a Microsoft competition. So that's one example of how we're using, you know, human-centered computing. And in general, we integrate, we're creating innovative solutions to real-world problems by integrating people, technology, culture, policy, et cetera, to address those problems. And we evaluate them in context with people.
Interesting, interesting. And are, so on, staying on that stroke example, do you have partners besides Microsoft? Is that being, is that past the sort of test stage and being rolled out at rehab hospitals now?
Not yet. We are, they're actually in the test stage of that technology, and they're designing it. So it will be test evaluated, and then that's where we look at technology transfer, moving it into the real world. We also have, since you're interested in that kind of thing, we also have a project. I have a student doing a dissertation on adverse drug interactions. So that project deals with an increase in the number of people who go to your local pharmacy, CVS or Walgreens or somewhere, and they get some kind of medication over the counter. And then they have an adverse interaction with a drug they were taking that was prescribed to them. So we are doing research to create a technology, preliminary, it looks like it's going to be a kiosk, that is multimodal, where you can touch it and actually maybe speak to it and scan in any medication that you want to purchase, and then it will tell you the potential in what we call plain language terms, potential of adverse interactions. So we're doing research in that area as well. So if you look in the health arena, we do have several projects that deal with technology, people, and again, policy and things like that.
Interesting. Well, and one of the other items that you mentioned, Dr. Gilbert, was working with kids and games. And I know that games is probably a misnomer because, you know, everyone thinks of, you know, very basic stuff. But I know that that's really a blossoming field, getting people trained using that sort of complex simulation and helping people skill develop. So talk a little bit about what you do in that area.
Yes. If you look at, I have a number of faculty working in this area. So there's a ton of projects we actually do. So one of them is I have one faculty member, Dr. Chandra Daly. She's funded by the Gates Foundation, and she does this stuff called effective computing. So effective computing deals with the ability to measure the affect or response to certain stimuli. And she's using these things, these little wristbands that they could put on individuals called GSRs, galvanic skin response meters. And what these devices do, they measure your sweat. So what you don't realize is whenever you have a response, you sweat. It may not be what we think of sweating, meaning perspiration when you're working out or something, but you do.
That's lie detector stuff, right? You catch me sweating while I'm lying.
Yes, it's very similar. That's not how we're using it, but yes. And so these GSRs, we're using those. And we're also using a brain-computer interface. I'll explain that in a second. But the GSR, she's using that with students and teachers to identify the topics and the things that the teachers are doing to engage students. When are the students actually engaged in the lessons at hand? So that's one example. We also have projects where we're creating animations where we integrate games and like hip-hop music to teach kids algebra. So we're teaching kids algebra using these metaphors and hip hop and animation.
Interesting.
So and then we use a brain computer interface to measure engagement with the GSR. So what we're trying to do is say, here are some strategies to teach someone something, and is it working? Let's see. Where are they engaged? And so we use these technologies to measure that, and then we can find out what really works and emphasize that in the classroom and other places.
Gotcha. Well, let's talk at you. Earlier I'd interrupted you. We talked a little bit about Microsoft being a partner. Obviously, one of your partners in this research has to be the federal government. So tell us a little bit about how you're working with the federal government to get their support behind these various initiatives.
Well, we write grant proposals to the National Science Foundation. Mentioned that the United States Election Assistance Commission is funding our research. Unfortunately, the days of what most people refer to as pork don't exist, where there's funding available for projects within states. So we compete with other universities and nonprofits for funding from the federal government for various projects, a lot of these projects and some that I didn't mention, but we do get funding from the government through competitions.
Very good. You want to give a couple of examples of recent success in that area?
Yeah, well, the probably the big one is our Election Assistance Commission. So they had an initiative called Accessible Voting Technology Initiative. And the goal was to make voting more accessible. And this was a $7 million grant initiative. We competed and we got $4.5 million of that. And then the other organization, ITIF, I think it's Innovation Technology and Information Foundation, they got the 2.5 other half. So our goal is to do research to figure out how to make voting more accessible for all people, but particularly people with disabilities, and also doing research on not only the technologies, but on the procedures, the protocols, meaning poll workers, election administrators, the whole process as well. And so that was probably one of our more recent big grants that we've received from the government.
Interesting. Well, Dr. Gilbert, we're going to take a brief commercial break. We're going to come back. We're going to get deep into that electronic voting initiative because I think that's very important and interesting to a lot of folks. Keep it here for more Capital Thinking.
Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, welcome back. We are talking to Dr. Juan Gilbert from Clemson University, a gentleman who has a great deal of expertise, one of the nation's leading researchers on innovative work in electronic voting, and so we want to delve a little bit deeper into that. Dr. Gilbert, maybe give us an overview of some of the challenges that are faced in voting access now and how the technology that you're developing attempts to bridge that gap.
Okay, so yeah, there are several areas. There's a precinct-style voting, so if you're an individual who's blind or a person that may have limited use of their hands or dexterity issues, voting on paper is impossible for some of them. Being able to mark it accurately, even for some older people, being able to fill in small ovals and reading the print. So being able to vote is a right, and it's not equally available to everyone. So that's a problem. And if you're a military person, if you're a soldier overseas, traditionally ballots were mailed, and then you fill it out and you mail it back. But the time that it takes for those to get back, even if they're mailed out early, often is such delays when they come back that the election has been counted and their ballots may not be counted. So that's another example of problems with accessibility in voting. So you have overseas voting. There's problems with accessibility there. You have people here domestically. In the last election, we saw an issue with the amount of time it took to vote, long lines. So you have a number of issues, the time, making it accessible for people who have disabilities or limitations, and then those overseas. So that's where it begins with us. That's the motivation for our research.
All right. Well, talk to us a little bit about, you mentioned in our last segment the big grant that you got. So tell us a little bit about what you're using that money to do to help access.
Okay. So the grant is funding a very large team, and I'll talk primarily about the things we're doing. If we have a chance, I can highlight some of the other things they're doing. But we've created a technology we call Prime 3, which is the premier third-generation voting technology. And this technology has it's software, 100% software, but we can put it on any device, so whether it's an iPad or a laptop or a phone, actually. But the technology allows you to vote by touching a screen, and or responding with sound. So you wear a headset with a microphone, and you could say vote to prompts or blow into the microphone. And we also have a switch where you can touch a switch that would allow you to navigate as well and listen to it through the headphones. So when we created this technology, this interface became the world's most accessible voting technology ever created, meaning it allows people that can't see, people that can't hear, individuals that can't read, and individuals, even without arms, can all privately and independently vote on the same machine as anyone else. And that was the goal of our research, and we've been able to create this technology. And the process is interesting because people will ask me, you have this voting machine, and people say, well, does it give me a record? Can it be hacked and things like that? So I'll walk you through the process. So imagine if you walked up to vote, and after they verify you are who you say you are, the poll worker takes you to a machine, and they put in a single blank piece of paper into a printer. And then the screen is on, and then you go through and you can vote. And you vote touching or responding verbally. And when you're done, it prints your ballot. And what it prints is only the actual contest or office with your selection. So if you voted for Barack Obama and Joe Biden, it would show president with Barack Obama and Joe Biden. It would not have, Mitt Romney there. So it eliminates ambiguity about who you voted for. And then that paper ballot is then placed into the ballot box and is scanned in a scanner. which takes a picture of that ballot, and then we have software that will read that picture and actually do the tally. So if you notice, the behavior here is actually going to tally like a human would, meaning it reads the ballot and then tallies. Whereas in other cases where they use optical scan or Scantron kind of things, it's reading for marks, looking for marks in specific places, which could increase error. So when we do this approach, we reduce the chances of the machine count or the tally machine count being different than if a human count. So we reduce that margin of difference there. So that's one example of how we're using Prime 3 and how it works. And for people with various levels of disability voting on the same machine as anyone else.
Interesting. Well, I know people are always surprised. Obviously, we had huge problems in the 2000 election, and then Congress passed, an act of design to focus attention on improving the technology, improving the voting experience. But I think people are always surprised to discover how different the voting experience is everywhere and how little of it really is electronic. So talk to us about a glide path to getting to 100% electronic voting.
Well, I mean, you're referring to the Help America Vote Act, which was passed in 2002. And I don't know, it's going to be difficult to get 100% there. There's actually a move to move back to paper for a lot of people, because what we've seen is in some places they have these voting machines that don't have a paper record of any sort. And some of my colleagues have shown examples where if you don't have that, you can easily modify votes and no one would ever know it. So the integrity of the election becomes questionable when you have those kind of situations. So what people have said, well, let's move back to paper because these machines are an issue. And we're saying there's a compromise there where you use the technology to create the paper. And so in our case with Prime 3, it's creating the ballot right there. So it eliminates this issue of people worried about someone hacking and changing the outcome of the election. We don't have those issues simply because we have the paper ballot that can be counted manually. And then, you know, we recently saw in this last election, probably the biggest thing, and President Obama actually addressed this, was the voting times. Those were horrible. I mean, 6-hour waits for some people. So what we've done is we've actually added that to our project, and we've addressed that through another technology that we call balloting, is what we refer to it as. So imagine, Kevin, if you the election's coming up, but you're able to go online on your laptop or your phone or somewhere, and you fill out a ballot. And when you fill out that ballot, you say, that's it, you hit submit, and then it prints one of these QR codes. You've seen like the square barcodes that you can use them at the airport, and you see them all over the place. It prints a QR code, and you can take that QR code on election day when you go in to vote, and you scan it on Prime 3. And what Prime 3 will do is bring up in our review screen those options that you selected. And then you could change them if you like, or you can accept them and print your ballot. So what does this do? Well, we did a preliminary study that we had people fill out a lengthy ballot, actually, on paper, and we timed how long it took them to do that, and then we had them fill out the ballot on an electronic voting machine, and then we had them do this balloting process. And what our preliminary data shows is that we can at least improve voting times by a factor of 20 using this method, where people can easily take as much time as they want to fill out the ballot, and then on election day, they're just reviewing and making a correction or two. So that process is something that we've done as part of this grant as another way to improve voting in the United States.
Very good. So you mentioned President Obama. Obviously, the president mentioned in his State of the Union address recently, put together this bipartisan commission on to look at the voting experience and make some recommendations. So if you were one of those people on that commission, what would you want them to be doing?
Well, I would want them to be, first of all, I want them talking to us so they could know what we're doing, because we've taken a look at this. I think the other thing they need to do is talk to election officials. As part of our team of this grant, we have the Election Center, which is located in Houston, Texas, led by a man named Doug Lewis. And they are an organization that works with election administrators all over the nation, poll workers, everyone. And so I think it would be wise to talk to those individuals in addition to talking to people like myself who are doing research in this area to say, okay, so look, here's the problem. We know the problem was these long lines, but why did it happen? And how do we solve that? Many people thought that if you just have people write on paper, you would eliminate the long lines, and that's not true. In our studies, what we're finding is that the paper, filling out the paper, takes longer than voting on the machines.
Interesting. So any other concrete suggestions you would give to that commission?
Well, that's where I would tell them to start. And I would say let the research tell you, you know, where to go, and hopefully the research informs the policy and the policy informs the research. That's how we see it. We see it as a circular dependency where our research and policy go hand in hand. And that's my advice. Hopefully we'll be talking to them, because we're doing research in this area, and we found something that actually improves voting times. And we actually think it would engage people in voting. So imagine this. If we were using our balloting approach, you'd have Democrats and Republicans creating bumper stickers and T-shirts with their QR code on it, saying, vote Democrat, scan this code. And you can actually scan it on your phone and see what it is. So it would engage people in voting, improve voting time. So this is just one proposal that we have, and I think it would be great if they talk to us and talk to the election administrators, the people who actually deal with the election.
Interesting. Well, I know you mentioned earlier students. So talk to me about the role that students play in your research at Clemson.
Oh, the students are the core of the research. So we have a graduate program. We have several students getting there, pursuing a PhD in human-centered computing. And these individuals come in, and they work on these issues. So I direct the research and help guide them in their dissertation topics. But they develop the software with myself. They go out and test it. So we do experiments. We'll go out to a county somewhere and have a mock election. We actually did a mock election in a Clemson elementary school. So we had kids, PK4, all the way up to fifth grade voting on our machines. And that was fascinating because we knew some of them couldn't read, but they were able to vote on our technology. So they run the studies. They help write the papers. They're there building the software, and we're training them. So they're learning about the policy, the technology, and learning about the people. So when these individuals graduate, they are very marketable for academic positions, but even more so research positions. I mean, Intel Research Labs has hired 5 of our students this year alone.
Interesting.
So,
Very good.
Yeah, the students are the core.
Dr. Gilbert, why don't you give folks your email or other website contact info if they want to learn more about you and your research?
Yes. You can find me at JuanGilbert.com, and you can find me on Twitter at Dr. Juan Gilbert. My email is just juan@clemson.edu.
Very
so
good.
Look forward to hearing from folks.
Dr. Gilbert, we appreciated having you on the show. We're going to take a break and come back and talk a little bit more about education policy here in just a minute.
Find out which guests are being featured this week. Read our network press releases and read the blog posts from your favorite hosts. Go to iradioblog.com today, powered by the Voice America Talk Radio Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Marhaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. We're continuing our discussion of education issues by looking at the high cost of college tuition and what it means for the future from a policy perspective. We're joined by Andrew Gillen, the Research Director at Education Sector. He's responsible there for conducting and overseeing that organization's research projects. He spent a lot of time researching and writing about higher education, specifically college costs, financial aid, accreditation, and the economics of higher ed. He's got a doctorate in economics, and we're delighted to have you on the show. So, Andrew, tell us a little bit first about Education Sector and its mission.
Well, thanks for having me. And Education Sector is an independent nonprofit organization that studies pretty much K through 12 through higher ed. So we're trying to figure out what policies will improve education and how we can provide an adequate education to all the students who need it.
Oh, very good. Okay. So I know my wife works in higher education, so I know we talk about this concept often, but there's a big difference between sticker price and what people actually pay, and some of the information that's out there about sort of average cost to go to school can often give people maybe the misimpression about what it really costs to go to a college. So talk to us about some of the facts and some of the myths, if you will, about education and its true cost.
Yeah, and that's a very, very good, good question, because what you see most of the time in newspaper stories is kind of the average tuition or the average, cost of going to college. And that's useful, but it's not personalized. And it can be a little misleading because it can make college seem unaffordable when in a lot of cases it's quite affordable. There's a lot of financial aid programs. The federal government has a whole slew of them. And then there's also, you know, all sorts of other financial aid programs that can provide money to help students afford college. So there's really kind of two things going on, with why kind of the average might be misleading. The first is that there's so much variation around the average. So, you know, the average tuition might be $7,000 to go to college. But if you look at community colleges, those are only typically a couple hundred dollars a class, if that. So those are quite affordable, and there's a lot of financial aid available for them. So, and kind of the second thing is takes into account the financial aid. So if you're from a low-income family, you're probably going to qualify for a Pell Grant. And that can cover a lot of the cost of college, and then you can borrow loans from federal programs. So that's really kind of the message, is that don't pay too much attention to the average, and do try to figure out what aid is available to you and how that affects your cost of going to college.
So net tuition, for example, and maybe talk a little bit about federal funding and the ability to get grants and whatnot there.
Yeah. So net tuition basically just takes the sticker price tuition. So that's what you see when you go to the college's website is kind of the sticker price. And net tuition basically just subtracts all the grant aid that you get from that. And most of the grant aid at a lot of colleges comes from the federal government. So it'll be things like Pell Grants or GI Bill aid or something like that. But increasingly, especially at private colleges, the institution itself will give you grant aid too. And sometimes these are need-based, sometimes they're merit-based, but you can think of these, a lot of times they go by different names too, so sometimes they call them scholarships, sometimes they call them, you know, grants. But the basic idea is that once you subtract all these different discounts that you're essentially getting from the school, and then also subtract the grant aid that the federal government is giving you, what you're left with is what we call the net tuition, and that's actually what it's going to cost you kind of out of pocket to go to college. Now, you can still borrow money to cover that cost in case you don't have enough cash right up front, but really the net cost is probably the best measure of how much it's going to cost you to go to college.
Well, I know parents are concerned net or gross. They just look at what they think is a fairly big number, and they look at the growth in comparison to things like inflation. So does your research give you a sense of whether or not we'll start to see a flattening of that growth curve in terms of tuition increases in the next few years, or is state spending reductions going to just accelerate that trend?
So unfortunately, I don't really foresee the tuition growth slowing down very much. The kind of the drivers of tuition are all kind of pointing towards continued growth in tuition, which is very unfortunate because we're already reaching the point where a lot of families are scared away by the high sticker price from going to college.
Interesting. So you don't see it slowing down. So I want to switch gears. I think you've done a little bit of research maybe into this emerging trend of these massive open online courses, the MOOCs. Tell me a little bit about whether or not you think they're here to stay, they're for real, and what sort of impact they might have on cost.
Yeah, so these are kind of the most exciting thing to happen to higher education and pretty much my lifetime, and probably for quite a few lifetimes before that. And the basic idea here is that these MOOCs have the potential to really transform the way education is delivered. And this can have an impact on quality, of course. A lot of students may actually learn better by watching the lecture online and then coming to class and getting kind of more personalized instruction during class time. So it has the possibility to affect the quality of education as well. But what it's definitely going to do is affect the cost, because you can show that video to millions of students. Whereas you can't show a lecture to millions of students. So you pretty much max out once you fill an auditorium with people. So you can't really deliver a lecture in person to more than a few thousand people. But by putting that lecture online, you can really reach so many more people. And what that means is that there's going to be really intense, downward pressure on the costs of delivering higher education. Now, what's keeping that from translating into lower tuition right now is that MOOCs are not yet degrees. So right now they're kind of standalone courses. And the way higher education is structured is that, you know, the courses are just kind of bundled together, and what you're really getting when you go to college is the degree. And until the MOOCs either replicate that or replace that model, there's going to be kind of this kind of uneasy tension between traditional higher ed and the MOOCs, because the MOOCs can do a lot of what higher education is doing, but we haven't figured out if they're going to do something completely different or if they're just going to do the same thing that traditional higher ed does, produce a degree but at lower costs.
And talk to me a little bit about what MOOCs will do. Obviously, you call this the most exciting, you know, development of your lifetime in higher ed, but it's got to place some pressure on traditional bricks and mortar universities. How will that affect, I guess, price if there is really something to this movement?
So this could definitely affect the amount of money that schools can charge for tuition. Now, for some schools, this is a very, very kind of dangerous development because some schools are very dependent upon their tuition revenue. So if the MOOCs are able to start providing an education for less tuition, then they're going to have to charge less, and that's really going to affect their you know, how much they can spend. But at the very top, so when we're talking about the MITs, the Harvards, the Yales, those schools aren't very dependent upon tuition revenue. So MOOCs won't really affect them. And it won't affect their finances that much. And that's what's really kind of interesting is that a lot of those schools are exactly the ones that are embracing MOOCs, which is very exciting because they have the credibility to say, you know, we're providing you a Harvard quality education in this MOOC, and that's something that's been missing from a lot of the lower cost offerings of higher education, whether they were online or not, even in traditional institutions that were offering kind of lower cost things. They didn't have kind of the credibility to say, you know, this is still a high quality a program, even though it doesn't cost as much as, you know, a car.
Interesting. Well, so I'm sure you must get hit up a lot for advice from parents of rising juniors and seniors about how to look and figure out what the best deal is for them cost-wise. What sort of advice would you offer to our listeners who are in that situation the next couple of years?
Basically, the best thing you can do is make sure you apply to more than just one school. So you send out quite a few applications, and really, if they're all coming back and saying that you're going to be expected to pay about $10,000, then that's probably what you're going to have to end up paying. But also pay attention to the opportunities that there are for ways of covering that $10,000. So make sure you apply for federal financial aid. Make sure you're applying for other scholarships that exist out there. And also shop around. So one of the things that's kind of most interesting about the generations that are coming up versus the generations that in the past was that you hear so many stories from older folks about how they always just wanted to go to the school and then they went and it was great, and that's not really an option for a lot of the younger generations because the cost of college has increased so much. So the school that you always thought that you'd always dreamed about going, that just may not be affordable for you. And it's not necessarily the worst thing in the world either, because, you know, chances are there's a school that's just as good right down the road from that school that you can actually afford to go to. So really shop around and make sure you're applying for aid is my advice.
Very good. Andrew, give us some information on how people can find out more about education sector and what you guys do.
Sure, we can. You can find us online at educationsector.org, and you can find our links to our blog and all of our publications there.
Very good. Well, Andrew Gillen from Education Sector, very interesting subject on MOOCs, but also just the broader questions of affording college today and college tuition. So encourage people to check out his blog and also their website. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk a little more higher education policy here on Capital Thinking.
Your favorite Voice America Talk Radio Network shows and hosts are in your car, outdoors, and wherever you need them to be.
Listen anywhere.
Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, we wrap up our interesting discussion today on higher education, March Madness, with Amy Budner-Smith, a public policy advisor here in our Patton Boggs office who handles a lot of higher education issues. Amy is available to talk to us during this segment because her alma mater is not in March Madness, so she doesn't care that much, but I'm required to mention that she won the office pool last year, so we'll see if she can go back-to-back. Amy, I want to talk not about the scoreboard, but about the President's College Scorecard he mentioned in the State of the Union address last month. Tell us a little bit about that and what it means for universities.
Yeah, sure. Well, this is a great follow-up to the conversation you just had with Andrew. You know, he was talking about how he sees the tuition growth at universities and colleges not really slowing down. I think the administration, the Obama administration, probably agrees with him. And in the president's 2012 State of the Union address, he actually put colleges and universities on notice about this, concerned about their rising tuition prices and the explosion of student loan debt, which was particularly disconcerting, I think, during the recession when graduates were facing a really tough time in the job market. We saw some pieces of the puzzle start to emerge throughout the year last year on making those costs more transparent. We saw things like the College Navigator website, and the administration even created a prototype for the scorecard last year and asked financial aid and college admissions experts to weigh in and provide some insight and testing before going public with it. Then last month, as you mentioned in his State of the Union address, he announced the public launch of the scorecard and stated that parents and students can use it to compare schools based on one simple criteria, where basically you can get the most bang for your educational buck. That was the idea. So this scorecard was unveiled the following day as a way to empower families to help make smarter investments in higher education.
Very good. Well, Secretary Duncan over Department of Ed, you know, basically was quoted talking about the scorecard giving you a snapshot about cost and value so family can make a decision, sort of like what Andrew was talking about, where best to enroll. So go through the specific information that's on the scorecard and give us your sense, your analysis of whether or not it achieves what the department says it does.
Yeah, you bet. Well, I think the department really wanted to provide the information in a clear but also interactive way, user-friendly way. So users can search for an institution by name or by selecting certain factors like the geographic location, certain majors offered by institutions, the size of an institution, or even distance learning providers. While I don't think MOOCs are yet on there, who knows, one day they might be, but definitely online education providers are included, and so on. You can search by different things. The information is presented in very simplistic fashion, and it does represent that snapshot that Secretary Duncan spoke of. But I wouldn't say that it's necessarily clear. While it's simple, not really that clear. And I'll give you a couple of examples. There are five key data points about each college's scorecard that the scorecard tries to capture. The first is cost. The second is graduation rate. Third, loan default rate. Fourth is median, or the average amount borrowed for each student. And the fifth is unemployment or earning potential data. And for each category, colleges are scored with a low, medium, or high mark. But no real information is given as to what constitutes those rankings. So there's no comparison nationally given, or whether it's, you know, whether they're compared to their peer institutions. So in this way, it's very simple to read and to understand, and somewhat easy to use and navigate through the site, but the information is not always presented very clearly, and with kind of more background or substance. And the other thing I think that's lacking a bit is that users can't make, those side-by-side school comparisons. So as Andrew was speaking about, you know, apply to several schools, apply to a bunch of schools when you get your letters back, you know, ideally you could go on the site and then maybe do a side-by-side comparison, on the scorecard and see what each college's scorecard is. But right now you can't do that. You have to go individually, enter the schools in, and then see what their individual scorecard is. The other, I think one of the other downsides, and I want to note that I think the department is continuing to revise the scorecard. We'll see another revision, so hopefully things like this will be fixed. But it lacks kind of a definition of key terms, which could be helpful, particularly to high school students and first-generation students whose parents have maybe never gone through this before. So the scorecard does not currently include links to certain other data points, which also could be helpful in getting the full picture about a college or university. So, for example, in the graduation rates category, it may be helpful for potential students to know what a four-year graduation rate is. Right now it's currently based on a six-year graduation rate. And for employment data, outcomes such as graduate average salary and employment outcomes by major or department could also be useful there. And while the scorecard does take into consideration transfer students in the graduation rate category, it does not do the same thing in the loan default and borrowing category. So you're not really getting the full picture of the loan default rates for students who started and ended at those institutions. And while I understand they're trying to keep the tool very simple and easy to read, I think sometimes the whole story isn't quite told in the scorecard. I know institutions and some higher ed associations haven't really been happy about that.
Very good. Amy, so tell me, if you're a college or university, you're one of my alma maters, Syracuse or William & Mary, what are you worried about in this scorecard? What are the things you got to check out?
Yeah, well, there are a couple of things. First, I would just say, on a kind of dissemination and public relations level, other than the initial buzz surrounding the mention in the State of the Union address and the initial launch the following day, there hasn't been a great deal of attention paid to it since then. And there's no real dissemination strategy that I'm aware of on the part of the Department of Education at this point. Therefore, you know, some families and students may get a little confused and lost in the whole mess of the department's transparency and accountability tools, you know, like I mentioned before, with such things as the College Navigator and the Net Price Calculator. That could be a good or bad thing depending on how your institution stacks up on the scorecard, but I think it is something to think about. And some other institutions in the higher ed arena are also developing their own tools, which, you know, may create a little more confusion, but I think eventually will probably lead to a better product at some point for families and students making their way through this. And I know the Chronicle of Higher Education is expected to unveil its tool in this arena next month, so we'll see what that looks like. But I think the other thing colleges and universities are really buzzed about right now is the employment data section. As I mentioned earlier, it's one component of the scorecard. And while there's a place holder for it now. There's actually no information included in it yet. The scorecard really just has a quote on there that says the department is working to provide, you know, information about average earnings for undergraduate students, and that you should talk to your college about getting that information in the meantime. So that's obviously an area of concern. I think some universities are wondering, you know, how that information is going to be collected and aggregated. I know for them to do so right now, it's very expensive for colleges to get that information, and they're worried about the credibility of it because it usually relies on self-reporting only. It also doesn't always account for things like undergraduates going into graduate school. So I know many state departments of labor are capturing this information and making it available, but currently, most of those are for their in-state institutions only, so it'll be interesting to see how kind of the national data is conveyed and how it compares. So that's something that's obviously coming down the pike on the scorecard. And then I think the last thing I would just mention, you know, I was actually with Undersecretary Martha Cantor of the Department of Education the day the scorecard was unveiled, and, you know, they were receiving all kinds of complaints about the scorecard, and she was a little frazzled about it, but she was also really excited about its potential and determined to make the data better and more meaningful for its users, I think. I know she's been talking to colleges and universities around the country seeking feedback on the scorecard. In fact, in our meeting, I had an institution whose name was listed incorrectly on the scorecard, and within days, the department was on it trying to fix their name. It's since been corrected since that meeting. So, you know, I think that a lot of the problem is that much of that data was dumped in from iPads and College Navigator, so had some inherent issues. But I do think it will get better, and I think that Undersecretary Cantor in the department, you know, is asking for colleges to share information and concerns they have about it, but also the good stories about their own return on investment and the value they provide and kind of the nuances of the data. I think they really welcome schools to share that kind of information, so maybe they can be used as examples of what's being right in terms of value in the higher education space. And, you know, I think they just want some good stories to tell.
Amy, speaking of good stories to tell, you're the defending champion in the NCAA pool. Close it out by telling me your final four picks.
Ooh, I know I have Indiana winning it all. I think I have them going with, you know, I didn't have many SEC dogs in this fight, particularly my Bulldogs. So, Louisville, I think Kansas, and possibly Georgetown, although, you know, past experience should tell me I probably should not have gone with them. So,
you're
but they're a local favorite.
Syracuse will win the national championship this year, maybe Gonzaga. So I don't know. But all right, Amy Budner-Smith, you can catch her at our Patton Boggs website if you want more information on higher ed. That'll do it for this week. We'll see you next week with more Capital Thinking.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management. Get the news on our shows and other happenings by following us on Twitter. Find us at VoiceAmericaTRN or Twitter.com/VoiceAmericaTRN.
Hey, did you know Voice America has partnered with the Kidstar Network to expand their reach through Voice America Kids? Voice America Kids will feature talk radio for kids by kids, along with special event programming and live broadcasts. Each program is conveniently archived for on-demand listening at any time. Please check our archives for the latest events and happenings on voiceamericakids.com.
Some great ideas arise on their own. Others need a little help getting off the ground. That's where